James Vincent McMorrow und ein Stück von seiner Debütplatte Early in the Morning, die 2011 erschienen ist. Wir haben ihn davon gehört mit We Don't Eat. Heute Abend spielt der Mann im schönen Huxleys und vorher hat das zu mir ins Studio geschafft. Wir quatschen über seine neue, zweite Platte, Post Tropical, die diesmal nicht in der irischen Provinz, sondern in Texas, USA aufgenommen wurde. Wir finden heraus, wie wichtig es war, ein paar Jahre vorher in London eben keinen Major-Vertrag abzugreifen. Wir sprechen über eine Video Trilogie, die im Frühling vollendet sein wird. Wir sprechen auch über die Pflege seiner Stimme, die wichtig sein könnte bei diesem sehr umfangreichen Organ. Wir sprechen über das Konzert heute Abend und vieles, vieles mehr. Zunächst sage ich aber erstmal hello and welcome.
Hi,
James Vincent McMorrow. How are you doing?
I'm really good. I'm really well.
Where are you coming from today?
Copenhagen.
Oh, wow.
Copenhagen. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I think...
But they pronounce it Schopenhagen as well. Which is super confusing. Yeah. That, we were there last night.
Cool.
In Vegas.
So. Hey, wow. Yeah. And how was that? How did the audience react?
Incredible. It's my first... I've never played a show in Copenhagen before. Never played at my own show. I've done some festivals there. So it was incredible. Place was absolutely rammed. It was really lovely.
And was the Copenhagen audience silent as well when you were playing? Because that's something that happens... At your shows all the time, right?
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were while I was performing. Yeah, like between they were screaming a
that's
lot.
Cool. That's a perfect combination, right?
Yeah. No, I love that. I love when people say what they feel between the songs, and then when we're playing, they're incredibly quiet. I've never had to request it. People always just quiet themselves.
Yeah, that's a cool thing. That's something that is really nice about an audience.
Absolutely.
Although the album has been out for a while, congratulations again on your second LP, Post Tropical. You've recorded that LP in Texas this time.
Yes.
And not in Ireland, not in a remote place somewhere in Ireland. No, I think the first one was in a real small, tiny place.
It was, yeah.
Because you couldn't afford anything else.
I couldn't afford a thing. Yeah, I couldn't afford a thing. Someone offered me a house, so I took that house.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I've never... never recorded anywhere other than isolated places, but this time it was in Texas.
And it was isolated too, right?
Incredibly so, even more so than Ireland is a small country. You know what I mean? Like, you're never that isolated. You know, you're never more than, like, you know, 20 minutes from a big town.
Yeah.
But this was properly in the middle of nowhere.
Wow, in a desert.
In a desert. And within the desert, we were in a farm. It was a pecan farm, so like an orchard.
Wow.
Huge orchard.
Wow. But being in isolated places, that's something that you need for putting out your creative energy, or is it just a coincidence?
I think at the time it's no more than coincidence. Like, I don't pick these places because of the isolation, but there has to be some other reason to it that I'm not really thinking about.
Okay.
I tend to be working on about 10 or 15 things at once because my mind is always wandering.
Yeah.
So I think probably when it comes time to knuckle down to making albums, it's better for me if I don't have outside distractions, like no TV, no people knocking on my door.
Yeah,
it's good.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong. Like, fundamentally, I just think for everybody,
it's good to
have a little bit of quiet.
If you went for a studio in New York City or something,
yes,
and you just leave the studio and you look around, you'd be like, wow, this is a beautiful, interesting city. Let's just have a look at it. And then you're lost in
absolutely.
That town forever.
You'd go out every night and it'd be difficult to get the work done there.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a reason for it.
Yeah. And the studio owner seems to be such a nice guy, because I've read some interviews where you talked about him, and he must have been a real generous guy.
Yeah.
Providing instruments.
Yeah, he was great. His name was Tony. He was a really just a genuinely lovely human being that only cared about the music. I think that he... Like, I mean, my experience with it was we were looking for studios and we found this place, and... obviously, the idea of going from Ireland to Texas to record is quite tricky on the face of it, because, you know, I have a studio in Ireland and all of my gear is there. And we were talking about filling a truck and moving it and stuff like that. So the idea of going to Texas...
Expensive idea as well.
It is. It was part of our plan, but going to Texas seemed a bit excessive. So I spoke to him and he just seemed completely confident that we wouldn't need to bring anything. He was like... He had everything that we needed, and he said that if he didn't have it, he'd buy it.
Wow.
Because he just wanted the album to be made there. He wanted records just to be made there. And I'd heard that about him before I'd spoken to him. Everybody who had dealings with him, who I know had made records there, had said that he's an amazing guy.
Beach House were there as well.
Beach House were there. Yeah, Animal Collective made a record there.
Wow.
Cool. Who else? Portugal the Man were there. There was a few bands that had all sort of shared, had a very strong experience with the place and with the people there. He has an amazing staff of people. And
he has a whole lot of instruments in there.
Yeah.
And that's something that might have been important for your new record, because the first record was mainly recorded with guitar and classical instruments that you could hear on other
standard
artists.
Instruments.
Yeah, standard instruments. Yeah. And then people got the misconception of you being a folk artist, maybe because of that.
Yeah, when you hold a guitar, I'm holding a guitar right now.
You're wearing a beard.
I have a beard. Yeah. You know, it's all very confusing. I think that there are things to that. I think that the studio had all these instruments. I had the album pretty well framed by the time we went there. It was a matter of just hitting my marks every day, articulating all the ideas. But the core of it was there. So all the sounds that are on the album were on the album before it came. But having said that, he added a layer of like his, you know, so say for instance, there's a lot of guitar and electric guitar in the record. His guitars were incredible. His amps, he had a, you know, 40 amp collection and his every instrument he had, whether it was an old analog instrument like a bass or a guitar or his drum kits or his more modern stuff, he had a lot of beautiful synthesizers that I don't own that added a level of sort of warmth to the record that I couldn't have achieved without it, you know. And there was a couple of really lovely, you know, like I've never used like a lot. Sub bass was something that I never thought about using on a record that much. But he had a Moog Voyager. Everything that we joke, because everything that Tony owned was like either like a number one. Like he had an old Moog Voyager. And we were looking at it one day and we realized that Bob Moog signs all of the Moog Voyagers, but it's like a steel imprint of his signature.
Yeah,
but we realized on this one, it was actually Bob Moog's signature because it was one of the first 200 ever made.
Wow.
So that's the kind of stuff that he had. And when you're using that kind of stuff, you try a little bit harder because you're like, well, this is old and this is important.
Some people say that in some studios where the old consoles are still in there and the old bands have been there, like, I don't know, all the ABBA records have been made there, that people go in there and they still kind of feel the vibe of those bands in that console.
Absolutely. Yeah,
people say that there's an electronic memory in those kind of things, you know what I'm saying?
I think that there is a merit to that. They're like, you know, circuits get changed, you know what I mean? Like these things are designed to have sound pushed through them. And sound changes. So there's definitely there's an element to that that is, you know, just your mind playing tricks on you, telling you that something is better. But like the desk that he had in the studio, half of it was from the Motown West studio. The other half was Madonna's old desk from the 80s in New York. So, you know, I mean, like these are desks that have had beautiful things put through them.
And
that makes you feel differently.
There must be some traces of it left in those things.
I'm pretty sure. Hope so. Yeah.
Let's listen to your new single, All Points.
Okay.
And then let's try to focus on the Motown and Madonna parts of that song. James Vincent McMorrow mit All Points heute Abend im Huxley's live auf der Bühne zu erleben. So, the show tonight, are you going to be on stage on your own, or did you bring some partners in crime?
I have three people on stage with
me. Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, we've quite a... Well, there's four of us on stage, and there's maybe 12 or 13 of us that tour.
Okay,
so we've got quite a few people around now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what I'm about to do, this is me and a guitar. This is literally the bare bones, which I do from time to time during the set, but it's a very big... It's a very big sounding set.
I mean, the changes that have been made, they can be seen on stage now as well.
I mean, that's the thing. The first album had a lot of big moments as well. Mm-hmm. It's just now we're just kind of, it's just bigger again.
What I found out today, and that I think that it's pretty interesting, I found out today that you do like to keep ideas for songs to yourself for a long, long time. You don't even write stuff down. That's how I understand it.
Yeah.
You keep them in your brain and and kind of like curate the next album with your brain. And, and is it like that you're... The songs that you forget about, they aren't worth the for the album, or how does it work?
Yeah, that's a pretty good way of saying it.
Uh-huh.
That if something isn't memorable, then it's not worth remembering. That's how I feel about music. So, if I have these ideas and they're staying with me. Like, for instance, I have a third record pretty much framed in my head at the moment, and I have some of it exists on my laptop, you know what I mean? Okay. There's enough ideas there, but the core of the ideas I haven't really touched yet. I know that they're there, and I know that I really, really am excited about it, but I don't like the idea. I don't like the idea of committing to something too soon.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it comes down
to. And I've read that you've stopped drinking a while ago, so that's good for your brain, so you can really keep those
ideas. It's good for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's good for, especially as a touring musician.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Like, you can become really, it can, like, touring can go from being the greatest party ever to the worst party that you can never leave.
Yeah.
Like, that's the reality of it. Like, and for me, I like drinking, but not as much as I like playing music.
Yeah.
It's pretty an easy one for me. So when it came to a point where it was just like, I'm not really having that much fun anymore.
Yeah.
Or I can't really remember the shows that well.
Stupid.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the thing is that it's like, if it ever, when I stopped, I was like, well, I want to see what this is like. And it was just a lot more fun. Yeah. It was a lot more terrifying.
And I really think it's a misconception that people have of musicians that you are partying all the time. Yeah. You can drink every night because you have to travel fucking long ways and then there's another audience waiting for you. And they want you to be fit. They don't want you to be fucking hungover. You know? So there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that job. And so many people don't see that.
Yeah.
They think it's a party job, but it's
not. And I think that's the thing. I think I went into it with that not really understanding the responsibility of it. And then realizing that we were playing really big shows. You know what I mean? We were doing, you know, I think we finished off a tour and it was like, you know, the London show, 2,500 people. And I just don't really remember the show. I remember thinking that was good, but not really caring that much and thinking exactly what you said, that's crap. That, like, you know, there's people that pay to come to see these shows. And here we are just kind of just getting in a bus, drinking, falling asleep, waking up and being competent enough to be able to pull it off, but that's not, you know, we're not here for a long time, like, so what's the point in just coasting through it? Like, I've never been like that in my life, so I just kind of slipped into this weird pattern of just going, well, the people are going to show up, so I'll play whatever show that I want to give them, and that's nonsense. Like, it's you know, if anyone comes to our shows now, they know that, like, I put it all out there every night because that's the job.
Yeah. And another thing that I was thinking about is your voice, because you have quite a big range that you're using. And I think alcohol is a bad thing for that as well, right?
It is.
Do you actually nurse your voice a lot while touring? Or
I mean, I tend to take, like, I have a bit of a cold at the moment, which is never ideal. But for the most part, I've only ever had to cancel one show, and that was in San Francisco. I've done shows where I've been in absolute ribbons, but my voice always holds up.
Cool.
You do have to take care of it. But like you say, if you don't drink and you don't really smoke, then it kind of takes care of itself. Like, as long as you don't, like, as long as you're not singing the wrong way. You hear a lot of singers and they develop all these weird things, and it's because they're trying to make their voices do something that their voice doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
I've never done that. My voice is exactly...
Yeah, but that's one of the most important things for an artist, I think, to discover his own or her own voice, you know?
Yeah.
Because so many singers, they sound like fucking Eddie Vedder their whole life.
And that will ruin your voice. Like, Eddie Vedder is that's how he is meant to sound.
Yeah.
But trying to emulate Eddie, and I did that, well, you know, when I was 16
everyone we're the same generation.
But it would ruin your voice. Yeah. Like, your voice would just, like, if I tried to do that now, my voice would just absolutely pack in after two songs because I couldn't do it.
Yeah, there's knots on your vocal cords then after
and
a while.
And a lot of people do that. A lot of people try and sound like other people. And I did that when I was a kid, but then you just kind of realize. Yeah.
But it's good. It's a good thing because many, many people, they try to discover their own voice and they can't find it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So now that you found your voice and you brought your acoustic guitar.
I'll sing a song.
Yeah.
Sure thing.
That will be so cool.
Okay, cool. I'll sing a song called Red Dust because I don't really play guitar much anymore by myself. But this is one that I used to play sometimes. So do you want to get that down for the guitar?
Yes.
Cool.
I will not cave under you. My heart is an unending tomb. I will not trouble your eyes. My heart is infinity blessed. an ancient club of old. And someone is ringing a bell. And a child
for James Vincent McMorrow and his live performance on Flux of MI. Goosebumps all over my body, my man. Beautiful voice and a beautiful performance. I think a little cold is really good because there's a little...
Yeah, maybe.
I love that.
My guitar was a little out of tune, but I thought I'd commit to it.
It was cool. Close enough for jazz, my man.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, thank you, James.
That's what I was thinking. This is jazz. It's all jazz.
aufs Konzert gehen möchte von James Vincent McMorrow, der ruft mich jetzt ganz schnell an. Ich habe noch Karten fürs Huxleys übrig. 030-2000-9000. Berlin 2000-9000 ist die Nummer zum Glück. Und wer durchkommt, der steht bei James Vincent McMorrow auf der Guestliste. James, it was a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure, yeah.
And I hope I'll see you again soon.
Yeah.
Next time you play in Berlin, you just visit us and you do another performance for us. So that was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.